to the Romans, looking for the last time at the first chapter, the second half of the chapter, from the 18th verse to the end. Very important passage, which speaks about how God has made himself known to us in the works of creation, and how men have turned away from the God of creation to worship creation rather than the Creator, and how that kind of idolatry and wrong religion leads to wrong living and wrong morals. First of all, then, from the 18th verse of Romans chapter 1, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven in the gospel against all the ungodliness and the wickedness of men, who by their wickedness sit down on top of the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has showed it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, God's invisible nature," that's to say, his eternal power and his deity, his Godhead, "has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. And so men are without excuse. For although they knew God in creation, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds became darkened. Claiming to be wise, like the Greeks, they became fools," morons is the word, "and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God speaks in creation for images, first of all resembling mortal men," start by worshipping men, and then you become more and more tasteless in the gods you worship, birds, animals, and snakes. "And therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they had exchanged the truth about God in creation for a lie, and they worshipped and served creation rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. And for this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error." That has a very contemporary ring, hasn't it? AIDS and all that. "Receiving in their own persons the due penalty for their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God in creation, God gave them up to a base mind and to improper conduct, You notice that phrase, God gave them up, occurs three times. In verse 24, in verse 26, and in verse 28. From verse 29 onwards, there is a catalogue of sins, mostly the sins of the Spirit. Verses 26 and 27 are about the sins of the flesh, involving people's bodies. But from 29 onwards, you get more refined sins, and indeed more heinous sins, the sins of the Spirit. Paul isn't saying that all sinners are as bad as this. Not all men have committed all these sins. This is not a description of the sins of all men. It is a description of the sin of man in the sight of God. They were filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity. They are gossips. Interesting that gossips are mentioned in the same breath as murder. Gossips are people who kill reputations, aren't they? Slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil. Another very contemporary one, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless. And another contemporary one, heartless, ruthless. Though they know God's decree that those who do such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but approve those who practice them. Amen. May God add a blessing to the reading of his holy word and grant us an understanding of it. It's important to see that from verse 18 of chapter 1 of Romans, right down to the end of chapter 2, Paul is really holding up for study three men. The first man is pagan man, the godless man who lives an immoral life. And he is found from verse 18 of chapter 1 right down to the end in the section which we read today. A godless, immoral man. The second man is the godless man, but who lives a moral, clean, and upright life. And he is found from chapter 2, verse 1, down to verse 16. He is introduced in verse 1 of chapter 2 in this way. Therefore, you have no excuse, O man, whoever you are, when you judge another. For in passing judgment upon him, first man in chapter 1, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, the godless moral man, are doing the very same things. And this second man, it takes you down to chapter 2 and verse 16. The third man is the religious man. And he is represented by the Jews. And he's found in chapter 2 and at verse 17, right down to the end of the second chapter. You notice that in verse 17 of chapter 2, Paul says, "But if you call yourself a Jew," and so on. And that's the third man. And the point of the argument here is this, that in the sight of God, there is no difference between these three men. They are all sinners in God's eyes. Their sins may be different, and some of the sins are worse than others, but they have a common sinnerhood in the sight of the holy God with whom men have to do. And Paul holds up these three men: the godless immoral man, the godless moral man, and the religious man, because he's now of his argument in this section. And that conclusion is found in chapter 3, in three verses. First of all, in chapter 3, verses 9 and 10. He says, in the middle of verse 9, "I have already charged that all men, whether they are immoral, moral, or religious, all men, both Jews and Greeks, are under the power of sin, as it is written," and of course he's quoting here from the 14th Psalm, "None is righteous, no, not one." Verse 12, "All have turned aside together, the immoral, the moral, and the religious. They are all sinners in the sight of God." In the 19th verse, he reaches another conclusion. He says the purpose of lifting up these three men is this, at the end of verse 19, "So that every mouth may be stopped." No more arguments, no more discussion, "so that every mouth may be stopped and the whole world be held accountable to God. And the third verse, the famous verse, the famous conclusion in verse 23 of chapter 3, taking in the end of verse 22, he says, "For there is no distinction between the immoral, the moral, and the religious, since all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." Or as the Greek says, "All have sinned and have kept on falling short of the glory of God." People try again and again and again. They fall short and they miss the mark. They keep on falling short of the glory of God. And that is Paul's verdict on his study of these three men. All of them share in the sinfulness of the race before God. And it's this first man who occupies the stage here in chapter 1, in the passage we read this morning. And I want to think about him today. The godless, immoral, pagan man. Now, some people suppose that Paul here is thinking of the Greeks. You know that the greatness of the Greek Empire had long since passed away by the time Paul reached Athens and Corinth. The glory that was Greece really existed 400 years before this, in the heydays of Socrates and Aeschylus and Euripides and all the intellectual giants of the Greek Empire. But by the time Paul reached Greece, Greece was rather run down. It was down at the heels. It was an empire living on its past memories and its past greatness. It was rather a shabby, immoral place. Atheists and agnostics were very common. And in fact, the word atheist and the word agnostic are Greek words. And the perversions of verses 26 and 27 were typically Greek perversions and sins, and were in fact the downfall and the ruin of Greece, as they have been part of the ruin and the downfall of every civilization since. Socrates was charged with corrupting the youth of Athens. The Greek warriors fought bravely in the wars because they had lovers in the army. It was said of Julius Caesar that he was a man amongst women and a woman amongst men. And so the suggestion is that this godless pagan man in chapter 1 is Greek. But of course, the picture is applicable to every age, and it's especially applicable today with the rise of what is called neo-paganism and the spread of the aggressive immorality in our time in what is called situational ethics. Now, situational ethics means simply that you ignore God's ethics and you just make up your own moral code and your morals as you go along, and you wait for the situation to happen before you decide to make up your morality. And so apply all this to the scene today, from chapter 18 onwards to the end of chapter 1. And in fact, this passage is really an expansion of the phrase in the middle of verse 18, God's wrath revealed from heaven against the ungodliness and the wickedness of men. In other words, ungodliness leads to wickedness, or as we can say, wrong religion leads to wrong living, just as right religion leads to right living. And the theme here is how wrong religion has led to wrong morals in this godless pagan man. And in the passage we read, there are really three phases in the argument. Phase one, God speaks to man in creation, and the voice of God is heard in the works that God has made. Secondly, phase two, men turn away from the God they see in creation. And they start worshipping creation rather than the Creator. Phase three, this wrong religion, this false religion, leads to immorality. And then in verses 26 and 27, you have a short account of fleshly sins. And then in verse 29 to 32, you have the catalogue of spiritual sins, the sins of the Spirit. And I hope it doesn't shock you if I say that the sins of the Spirit, in verse 29 onwards, are much more offensive in the sight of God than the sins of the flesh in verses 26 and 27, although they are all heinous in God's eyes. The Bible is very hard on the sins of the Spirit. Let me illustrate this. Indulgence in strong drink may take a man to hell. Being proud will also take a man to hell. Indulgence in strong drink is a sin of the flesh. Pride is a sin of the spirit. And the only difference between them is this, that being proud will not land you in the gutter on a Saturday night. You can be proud and religious. You can be proud and sit in a church pew Sunday by Sunday. The one is a sin of the flesh, and the other a sin of the spirit. Let's look at these three phases briefly this morning. First of all, then, God speaks to man in creation at verse 20. And Christians have always believed that creation is a primary evidence for the existence of God. Who made you? If you ask a little child, he'll say, God made me. Who made the stars? God made the stars. Who made the flowers? God made the flowers. And so on. And this stands as fundamental in God's revelation of himself to man. God speaks to us, first of all, in his works of creation. The voice of God is heard in the created world. As the psalmist says in Psalm 19, which rejoices in this, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament of the sky proclaims his handiwork. Actually, the two Hebrew words there, declare and proclaims, are used of a brook rushing on. It should really go like this: the heavens are bubbling over with the glory of God, and the firmament is gurgling his handiwork. Creation preaches a God. The voice of God is heard in the works of his hands. I wonder if you know the 10th hymn in our church hymnary. Turn it up. Marvelous words by Joseph Addison, the English essayist of the 17th, 18th century. Wish we could sing it. The hymn, the tune isn't awfully good, but the words are marvelous. Hymn 10. The spacious firmament on high, the sky, with all the blue ethereal sky and spangled heavens, a shining frame, their great original proclaim. The unwearied sun from day to day does his Creator's power display and publishes to every land the work of an almighty hand. Soon as the evening shades prevail, the moon takes up the wondrous tale and nightly to the listening earth repeats the story of her birth. While all the stars that round her burn and all the planets in their turn confirm the tidings as they roll and spread the truth from pole to pole, what though in solemn silence all move round the dark terrestrial ball? What though no real voice nor sound amidst their radiant orbs be found? In reason's ear they all rejoice and utter forth a glorious voice, forever singing as they shine. The hand that made us is divine. Creation preaches a God. Now, of course, creation doesn't teach you all that there is to know about God. And in a sense, if God spoke only in creation, we would have a very limited knowledge of him. Paul says in verse 20 that we learn three things about God by looking at the universe and the stars and the planets and the seas and the flowers. First of all, his invisible nature. Secondly, his eternal power. And thirdly, his deity. In other words, what you learn about God from creation is this. First of all, he is invisible. Can't see him. Secondly, he's very powerful. And so you should fear him. God of earthquakes, the God of storms and volcanoes and winds and rain. And thirdly, that God is sovereign and he has absolute sway and is in absolute charge. You can't see him. He is omnipotent and he is sovereign. And that's what creation is saying to you about God. Notice, there's nothing about morals. You couldn't tell by looking at nature that God wanted you, in the words of Micah, to do justly and love mercy and walk humbly with your God. You couldn't tell by looking at nature that God loved you or that he wanted to save you and bring you to a knowledge of himself. You couldn't tell by looking at the stars and the moon and the sea and the moors. You couldn't tell that God expects you to live a righteous and a holy life. You see, creation preaches a God, but it takes God made flesh to preach salvation. But there it stands, the invisible God, the omnipotent God, the sovereign God is declared and revealed to man in the works of God's hands. But, amongst the greatest buts in the world, men have turned away from the God who speaks in creation. And they've started worshipping not the Creator, but the things He's made. Of course, you see this at its most primitive and naked, in people bowing down to gods of stone, and gods of wood, and gods of gold, and gods of silver, rather than bowing down to the God who made stone and wood and gold and silver. But the real truth about idolatry is more subtle than that. The Bible teaches that anything, whether good or bad, can become an idol and usurp the place of God in a man's heart. You can worship your religion. You can worship your marriage. You can worship your job. You can worship your family. You can worship money, success, popularity, the adulation of man. As Martin Luther once said, the heart of man is an idol factory. About 10 years ago, a fascinating book came on the market. It was called The Status Seekers. And one of the themes in the book, The Status Seekers, was the way in which the idols that men worship keep changing from age to age, and indeed keep changing with bewildering speed. In the 1930s, radios were very uncommon, and only a few homes had them. And so if you had a radio, it was a kind of status symbol. I can recall from my early boyhood, my father receiving a severe lecture from my mother for having taken home a Kosser radio, which she thought we could ill afford in those days of financial depression. In the 50s came black and white television, and that became the rage, the symbol. And soon color arrived, and large screens, and it became old-fashioned to have a black and white set, and so on and so on. The family car after the war years, the E-type Jag. Don't you remember when it was the desire of the heart of every young man to be in an E-type Jag? Washing machines, foreign holidays. I spoke to a very ordinary couple some years ago. They'd just come home from Mexico, and the year before they'd been in Japan. And at this very moment, we are living in one of the most idolatrous ages since the fall of the Roman Empire. People surround themselves with the status symbols. One of the great gods of our day is the god of science and progress. Have you ever wondered why you see people in white coats in laboratories on television trying to sell you the most unlikely product? Scientific tests have proved, says the man in the white coat, that children who use Mentadent have far fewer fillings than children who use other brands of toothpaste. And backing the claim is the view of a laboratory with charts and actors and actresses dressed in white coats. Science has said it, so it must be right. You'll notice that Whiskers is pushing cat food along the same lines. There's this picture of a man and a woman in a laboratory testing cat foods. Do you know it? Milling around are all the pussies, mewing with their tails in the air. The lady scientist in the white coat puts down a saucer with the new scientifically tested whiskers. And hey presto, more cats prefer that. Science has proved it. Now, you see, these adverts are only successful because science is one of the gods of our age. And of course, the tragedy of all idolatry is that false gods are rivals to the true and the living God. And to turn from God to other gods is to turn from the true to the false, and from the one to the many. God speaks in creation. Men turn from God and start worshipping idols. And according to Romans 1, that's not the end of the story, because Paul goes on to say that sooner or later, idolatry gives way to immorality. Wrong religion leads to wrong morals. And as verse 18 says, ungodliness leads to wickedness. Verses 26 and 27 mention perversions and aberrations of the natural emotions of men and women. I must say that in my pastoral work, I find that many ordinary folk are bewildered by the way in which that sort of thing has risen to prominence in our generation. The gay liberation movement is very aggressive and self-assertive, not only in everyday life, but also in the media. In many of the plays and the soap operas on television, it's somehow taken for granted that that kind of lifestyle is all right for particular people with particular problems and questions of morality and God don't come into it. Recent court cases in America have been dealing with parents anxious because some of the school teachers in the high schools have been introducing thoughts of sexual ambiguity into their lessons and confusing the basic issues of male and female in the minds of susceptible teenagers. And as you know, all kinds of attempts are made to respectabilize and legalize and make acceptable practices that are censured and forbidden in the scriptures. I always try to exercise great compassion in these matters and as much understanding as I can summon up. But Christian compassion apart, I want to say this very plainly. There are certain actions in the Bible, and they are called an abomination to the Lord. And it is not possible for man to bless something that God has cursed. It's interesting that three times in this chapter, Paul uses the phrase, God gave them up. God gave them up. God gave them up. Do you know where the filth and the base immoralities of our generation come from? They come from idolatry. And idolatry starts when men, in their madness, turn away from the God who speaks to them in creation, the God who is over all, blessed forever. When they turn from him and say their prayers to the objects of creation. I suppose the last invitation of this chapter must be the invitation to come back to God. Come home to the God who made you. Come home to the God whose voice is heard in the things he has made. Come back to the God who created you and who is waiting even now to recreate you in Christ. Come back to the God who speaks in creation, if for no other reason than this, that if you depart from him, you never know where it will end. Amen. May God add a blessing to the exposition of his word. To his name be honor and praise.